House Committee on Revenue for Thursday, February 9th, will come to order. Colleagues, we're going to take things a little bit out of order because of the situation where our staff has to be in two places at once. So I want to open the public hearing on the bill, the first bill we carried over from yesterday, House Bill 2281. We'll open that public hearing. Paul, do you want to whoever's introducing that?
Okay. It's Kyle. So it's a property tax.
Oh, Kyle. Yes. Let Kyle introduce it, and then we'll take the public hearing. Okay. Yeah, we've got a long list here.
Yes, we'll be lucky to get through it. Okay. So yes, good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 22.
PUC information. Okay. All right.
I'm sorry. That's why.
Thank you.
The bill order is right.
The bill order is right, but okay. So we'll temporarily suspend the recess the public hearing on House Bill 2281, and we'll open the informational meeting involving the PUC symmetrical gigabit exemption report. Who's going to report on that? Who's going to set that up?
Kyle.
I can set that up. Go ahead. Yes, that is yours, of
yes.
course.
Yes.
We passed the bill last.
Yes. Yes, Mr. Chair.
That's a number, yeah.
So as you just stated, we do have Brian Conway, the PUC, which will be giving the gigabit exemption report, which they were required, are required to present in a Senate Bill 611 of 2015, had a reporting requirement. And I do have, there are a couple pieces of material in the meeting materials. It's not under any of the bills. It's just under the general meeting. And I'm happy to go through them. One of them is a little background on property tax central assessment in general. And then I have it's a two-page document that hits some of the high points of Senate Bill 611. So I can step through those if you like, or we can.
Well, I think it's a good idea because we've got a number of new members and actually.
Mm-hmm. Even returning ones who don't remember.
And returning ones who don't remember. Thank you, Representative Nellis. So we probably got to do that as a bit of background so that people understand why the PUC was asked to do this report and why they're here.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. So, Mr. Chair, I will start with a quick overview of property tax central assessment, and then I'll get into Senate Bill 611 from 2015, which dealt with central assessment issues. So the document I'm referencing in the meeting materials, it's just titled Property Tax Central Assessment Background. And I won't read it word for word by any means. The key component in central assessment is most property is in Oregon is assessed by local assessors, and that's going to be real and tangible property and personal property. There are two components of property that's taxed or that is valued by a Department of Revenue, and that's you have larger industrial properties, which I won't go into detail here because they're not related to it, and then you have what's referred to as centrally assessed properties. And in many ways, those are commonly referred to as utility property as well. And you can see up on the screen there, that's the list of the types of properties that fall under central assessment. Right. So Department of Revenue, what central assessment is, it's done a little bit differently. One of the key components is it includes intangible values, where at the local level, when the assessors go out and do it, they're really just looking at the property, the physical property that's out there, where central assessment takes a unitary approach to assessment. So the general idea there is you would look at possibly a company at a national level or even in a worldwide level, if they extend that far, attempt to value it at the worldwide level, and then apportion that value back to Oregon. And this may sound a little bit similar with some of the corp discussion you've had here. It is a little different, but some of the same concepts where you look at the global or the national level, get a value there, and then find a way to bring that value here to Oregon, what's attributable to the property here in Oregon.
Mr. Chair, may I ask him a question?
Yes, please.
Okay, so just so I'm tracking, when you say take a unitary approach, that's that you mean that's the phrasing we use for assess the value of some company and then figure out what its share of that value is generated or created in Oregon or residing in Oregon or however we decide to tax it.
Yes, that's the general idea, yeah.
Okay.
You might give a really simplified statement of the other method so that we can contrast them.
To local assessment, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yeah, so local assessment, you would go out and just assess the actual property. So if it's a fabrication site or something to that effect, you would just go out and value the property, the actual tangible value of the property. You wouldn't look to say, what's the value of the company, and then work your way down. You would just go look at the physical property, more or less.
When we do a local assessment, are we looking at that property's intangibles as well, or is that only something we're doing for corporations?
Representative Nose, it's the distinction's not for corporations. It's just whether you're locally assessed or centrally assessed property.
Okay.
And the example that's given in a lot of ways is, and I'll use the utility example, is if you were looking at a railroad, and if you locally assessed it, you would go out and look at the track that actually runs through Oregon.
Got it.
And that would be valued based upon, you know, the value of the track.
Miles
itself.
Of the track in my county.
Yeah, and how much it would cost to replace that track or something to that effect. But a better way to value what a company would be willing or another company would be willing to pay for that railroad is to say, what's the value of the railroad in its entirety? So the fact that you can run track from California up to Washington or something to that effect changes the value of the property.
Sure.
And that's the idea behind looking at it as a unitary approach to valuation.
Okay. All right. It's just another way to do it.
Yes.
It's not necessarily better or worse. It's just different.
Let me make an attempt at it. What we're trying to do is fairly evaluate the actual value of the property. If you evaluate the railroad solely on its, for example, its replacement cost, you miss the fact that it's extremely valuable for making money for the business, and therefore they would be willing to assess the overall system at a much higher amount than the individual pieces would be evaluated based on their replacement cost, because they're worth a lot more to them as an operating business.
Correct. I feel like I understand that, but then when I try to work it backwards in my brain, I get confused, because then you ask me to say, well, how much of that overall unitary value is based in Oregon, and I struggle to figure out how to do that, what the math of that looks like, right? Like, don't you then end up having to go back and say, well, how much of this property is actually residing in Oregon, and look at it that way, right?
What's the numerator that you...
Yeah, Representative Nose, there is, I'm looking for the statute reference, but there is somewhere in the document. But it talks about, if you're talking from like a utility standpoint, in a lot of cases you come up with that larger value. And I guess the first step would be, if you're valuing on a unitary approach, you're probably going to come to a higher value because you're including your intangible value.
Sure.
Than if you just summed up, even if we're looking at a national company, if you summed up all their property nationally, but just the tangible portion of the property, you'd come to a different value than if you value the company with that intangible value. So you almost start from a higher number that then would get a portion to work again. But the direction, and this is the allocation process, so it's in 308.550 sub 1 and 2. DOR is required to allocate based upon the number of miles of rail, wire, pipe, pole lines, and so on and so forth, which really applies to utility property. But then if none of those apply to a way to bring in that value here to Oregon or allocating it to Oregon, then DOR is allowed to determine a process that would fairly represent how to do that. So it may not work. You can't, if you're not talking about a railroad, you can't use number of rail lines or something to that effect to attribute it back or allocate it back to Oregon. So they use some other factor to try to bring that value appropriately here to Oregon.
Okay.
I have a question.
Yes, Representative Hernandez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Rob, for asking those questions, because now I get it a little bit more. What are the tests? Maybe we'll get into this, but what are the tests for those two types of assessments? When does one not get triggered, and when does another one get triggered?
Yes, Representative Hernandez, it's in 308, ORS 308-515, and it really does list, if we scroll back up to the top, it does list those type of companies. So that's really the triggering method. And that's there's some background. It's at the end of this page that actually talks about part of the change, if you will, was beginning in 2009-10 tax year. DOR made some adjustments to how they classify communication companies. So they brought in companies that, prior to that change, were locally assessed. What they were doing fits more with the communication structure, so they came under the central assessment. So it's that's, I mean, the statute is what divides or sets the line there between the two. Okay. So that, as I said, this is at the bottom of the second page of this document, does talk about the recent developments and some of those changes on the communication property. That was upheld, the bringing the companies under the communication umbrella was upheld in Comcast Court, the Department of Revenue. That's still, the court case part of it has been remanded back to tax court, so that's still working its way through. But the reclassification, if you will, as communication was upheld. And I do, then I would just call attention to a couple of the charts that I included there that just give some sense of the size and the scope of centrally assessed properties. The first one is just the breakdown of the type of companies within there. So you can see the largest in terms of assessed value is electric, followed by communication, gas, and so on down the line. And then at the very bottom, you can see this is the percent of tax certified by type for fiscal year 15-16. You can see centrally assessed property make up not quite 4.5% of the tax that was certified. So that was imposed. Just to give you some sense of the amounts that we're talking about, or proportion at least.
I know what I'm doing on Sunday afternoon. Okay.
Okay, so that covers the reports at a very high level, central assessment. So the next document I'd point to is the background on property tax exemptions for Senate Bill 611. So again, this is the general idea or behind the document they see up there is really to hit this at a very, very high level. That's just a reminder of what was contained in that piece of legislation from a couple of years ago. And there were, in addition to some changes on the property tax base related to, I include those at the end related to data centers. That was really a base change. But in terms of exemptions, there were three primary changes from Senate Bill 611. There was a new exemption that's related to the historic cost of property subject to central assessment. There was an expansion of an existing property tax exemption to include, it expanded an exemption available for the value of FCC licenses. It now includes the value of franchises and satellites. And then the third, the third new exemption created, and the one that the PUC is here to talk about, is what's commonly referred to as the gigabit exemption. So this was an exemption that was made available to communication companies that build, make sure I get the terminology here, build, maintain, and operate a qualified project in Oregon. And that was related to symmetrical gigabit service being provided. So the general idea between with the gigabit exemption was there's a component where PUC has a certification responsibility and a reporting responsibility as well, and then DOR has an actual exemption qualification component. So there's two steps. You start with the PUC, and then you go to the secondary step. And included in that was the requirement the PUC would come each year, if needed, each February to brief the committees. And that is the report we have in front of you. It's in the media materials as well. Unless there's other questions I can try to address.
Okay, that's the background. Let me just add a couple of pieces from a political policy point of view. This Bill 611 included three different components. And this was only one of those three. And what the legislature was considering at the time was a potential plan by Google to install a gigabit service in Portland. And there was a significant interest in the legislature to figure out if there was a way of encouraging them to come. And so the bill was written with the intention of making it easy for Google to come. The way it ended up being interpreted in the PUC, which is an issue we'll probably get to in a little bit, it ended up being significantly broader than that, and we ended up with the determinations of the PUC in March, and this report as it comes out today. So I'm very interested in hearing where things stand now, and that's what the report's about. And we're very pleased to have you here today. If you'll introduce yourself to the committee, and then make your statement, we'd appreciate that.
Sure. Thank you. Good afternoon. Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Bentz, Vice Chair Smith-Warner, members of the committee. My name is Brian Conway. I'm the administrator of the Telecommunications and Water Division for the Oregon PUC. So it's my staff that put together the report for the commission, who ultimately approved it and has sent it forward. Kyle touched on a few things I was going to do here, but just to make sure it's clear, obviously 2015 legislature enacted Senate Bill 611 that allows companies with qualified projects to then go approach Department of Revenue and ask for an exemption for the intangible property. And so what I wanted to emphasize there is we're really just step one. If you get a qualified project from us, then you are allowed then to go ask for the tax break. If you don't get one from us, you can't ask for the tax break. And so I just wanted to bring that, because I think at times I heard some confusion as to whether or not we're granting a tax break. Mm-hmm. And I want to assure you that the PUC has no authority to grant tax breaks, and we have not granted any exemptions. So the end result is that we had three different companies come in, and all three made a case that working with Department of Justice found that they met the requirements. And so what we saw the requirements as is that, number one, you had to have new capital investment. Number two, you had to provide gigabit symmetric service, or actually it's something close. It was nearly approximately gigabit. Third, you had to offer this to the majority of her broadband customers in Oregon. And then fourth, that you couldn't deny any service based on income levels to anybody. So based on that, we had three that came in and asked, and we found that all three did. Now, there's some interesting features about it. Number one, Google came in. They were granted a qualified project status so that they would be able to go to DOR and ask for an exemption. But their project was something that I have to say I didn't recognize as being possible when I was sitting through all the Senate Bill 611 hearings and talking to you. It was a completely future projected project. And so, you know, it turned out, I guess, Legislative Council agreed and Department of Justice agreed with a lot of the attorneys from Google that, yes, future projects were allowed. And so then Frontier Communications, for its it bought property from Verizon. It's essentially the Fios footprint. And they were kind of half and half. They'd started their project, but it wasn't operational yet. So it was a little bit more than just a plan, but it wasn't fully functional. And then we had Comcast being the third one that came in and asserted that not only did they have a plan for it, but they actually had it in place and could offer service. Once you get a qualified project, once it's actually operational and running, that's when you go to Department of Revenue and ask for the tax break. What I remember back then was this was about trying to build out broadband, to try to push out high-speed broadband in Oregon, to try to advance the technology that was out there. And we get that. We do have, as Kyle said, a reporting requirement on an annual basis, presumably, on everybody who got the exemption. And I'm going to address that because Comcast did not get an exemption from DOR. But, yeah, we do have information about them in here, and I'm going to explain why. The reason why, or at least part of it, is that I view the purposes of these reports is that you enacted a tax break. Should somebody take advantage of the tax break and build out this, that you want to see, how effective is it over time? I think on day one, a very high-speed internet may not be the most you know, people may not need that. I personally don't feel I need 1 gigabit service right now. Maybe I would down the road. But, you know, so that it was acknowledged that, hey, this may take time. It may take some people to get in there, start using it. Maybe some applications come along to make it more appealing to folks. And so we would have an annual report going forward so you could kind of cumulatively see what impact this is having. So we did report on Comcast, and there's basically two reasons. One, I think it's fairly well known that there's that they didn't get the exemption and that there's a, probably a multitude of tax cases all bundled together here that's, if nothing else, fairly convoluted, at least from my perspective. I'm not an expert in taxes. But, you know, should they eventually actually end up with a tax break, then at least we would have a starting point. We could see, you know, what information there was available at the time and move forward. Should they not, I viewed it as nothing more than an opportunity to show you what we would report and find out if this actually meets your needs. Is this the information you wanted in a report? So I, you know, I have those two parts. So to the specific information about Comcast, I just summarize it as through the working with staff and going through to the actual hearings with the commissioners where they decided that these projects should be qualified, they were able to bring forward and say that they had spent $67 million in new investment, that they could offer this service or had the capability of offering it to approximately 3/4 of their customers. What they provided was a map showing their fiber footprint, and then it was the number of customers within, I believe it was 1/3 of a mile of that fiber footprint that they would build to each and every one of those. It happens to be that Comcast generally operates in some of the more dense populations. So it's obviously it's the Portland metropolitan area, the Salem metropolitan statistical area down through the valley. So they're not out in the really spread out areas. So more people are closer to their fiber footprint if the population is very dense. They did offer it to residential and business customers. I think, you know, as people have noted, the price was fairly high, so it may not have been the most popular service right out of the gate. And then finally, that what we did to look for the no denial of service based on income was look at the areas for which they reported they would serve and found that throughout all those areas, we found no really significant differences between the demographics or the income and poverty levels in the different areas for which they were serving. So it didn't appear to us that there was any, like, moving around a particular census area something or moving out of, you know, ignoring a neighborhood and moving around over here, that they seemed to be, you know, fairly ubiquitous throughout the footprint that they already had in place. So obviously they didn't get the exemption. I think I was, what I'm telling you is we put this together for those couple of reasons. One, to find out if it met your needs. And secondly, to report just in the chance that it ends up being a baseline for down the road if they do end up with an exemption. Other than that, we took advantage of the opportunity you gave us to provide, say, other information that we thought you might find useful. Frankly, it's pretty interesting. There are some other pieces out there that really go to a lot of the work, you know, through the ARRA grants and stuff like that. Obviously, there was a lot of broadband mapping over the last 6 years or so. And then in some cases, there's been states that have had put in, we have a broadband advisory council, but other states have put in like broadband summit areas and stuff like that where they actually have grants and they're going out and trying to put more broadband out there. They do other work as well. And so anyway, there's been a lot of work tracking things and trying to measure things. So as I look at what we were able to provide, I think one, fairly pleased to see that, you know, relative to the other states, Oregon has a fairly high median speed for broadband, for download speeds at around 49 megabits per second. When we look at what types of services have the fastest speeds, it is it really is a technology issue. DSL doesn't provide those high speeds. It is coax cable and fiber networks that can provide the higher speeds. And so we found that out here with Frontier Fiber, Optima, Charter, Comcast, Cox, those providing the highest speeds compared to the other providers, say an AT&T or a CenturyLink. And I do understand that some of those companies are moving out in fiber, but this was as of 2015. The other information we provided is that we looked at what activities other states are doing, both with a broadband office and without. And I suppose it's unsurprising, but those with a broadband office are doing more mapping. They're doing more adoption and data collection, things along those lines. I do note that the Broadband Advisory Council has done a lot of good things with that, putting together plans to help communities, you know, attract broadband and also get their people together so that they're more available. I know they provide reports to you on a regular basis identifying any legislation or anything that may be hindering broadband adoption. And so, some of the other states, like New York, actually has like $500 million that they can go out and match other grants and really try to encourage broadband development throughout their state in usually private partnerships, private-public partnerships. And so I think that's, you know, the broad overview. I knew you had the report. I didn't necessarily want to just go through and read the report back to you. If you have any questions, I'd certainly be willing to answer them. And
thank you. Questions now? Yes, Representative Dennis.
Thank you. The $67 million, was that for the gigabit installation?
Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Bence, the $67 million, it was for the property. It was read as broader than simply just what enabled the gigabit, because the way we read it was in ORS 308677 is that it took installed real or tangible personal property constituting infrastructure that enables the company to offer communication services, including the capacity to provide at least 1 gigabit. So it looked like to us that it was broader than simply the gigabit, that it was communication services that also included that as well. And so they provided that as new infrastructure, and it really was, in my opinion, it was the fiber network they were building out, and it did allow for the gigabit symmetric service.
Please, yeah.
Does it, and I have, forgive me, I haven't read the report, but does it include the amount of the difference between that which would have been paid, what the exemption is costing? Does it include that?
Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Bence, I'm sorry.
If you make the grade, you get an exemption. You don't have to count the value of the intangibles. Thus, an exemption. Do we have a comparison between that which they pay in property tax on the $67 million on the one hand as compared to that which they would have paid but for the carve-out? Do we have that number?
Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Bence, no. Okay. I don't have that number. We looked at it as here is the project, and then whether they get the tax exemption or not is a decision for Department of Revenue. We weren't looking at the value of the tax exemption they would receive.
Yeah, let's hear from Kyle too on that question.
Well, and just to that, Representative Bence, as Brian mentioned, no exemption has been given at this point. It's just PUC gave the okay to the project, I guess, for the certification, but no property tax exemption has been received. If one is to be received, there are reporting requirements that will have that information included. So the counties are required to report to Department of Revenue the difference, the amount of the exemption and the difference there, the delta, if you will, of the tax for both the current year, and then I think they're required to estimate out 1 year as well. So if an exemption is qualified for and received, that information would be contained within the PUC report, because there's also reporting requirement that DOR will then send that information to PUC.
Question for Kyle.
Yeah, please.
And so I thought for some reason that one of the three did make the cut.
Right.
Comcast isn't yet, but one of the other two did or not?
None of the three have received the exemption. It's a two-step process. So the first step would be to get the certified project or the certification of the project, more or less, the okay from PUC. Comcast has received that. They have not received the exemption, though. So the step two is to attempt to get the exemption through Department of Revenue, and that has not happened.
So.
Are you finished?
For the moment, thank you.
Representative Marsh.
Well, I just wondered if you could detail what the decision-making process is. So PUC is passed on a qualified project. So then what does what process does Revenue go through to issue that exemption?
Mark, you're here. Do you want to talk about that?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Mark Garst with the Oregon Department of Revenue Property Tax Division. So there, you know, as it's been described, there is a two-step process, and the PUC did grant three networks status as a qualified network. And so the question then becomes, do they get the property tax exemption? We feel that the department has a role to play in that decision, and that was clearly elaborated by the Public Utility Commission when they had their meeting. They said, we are evaluating these four standards. Do more than 50% of the customers have the service? Is the service fast enough? Are you denying access to anybody because of income? And then they said that they were not making any determination as to whether the project had been built, maintained, and operated. So Google, obviously, hadn't built. They had no property. They're not going to receive the exemption. Frontier agreed that they didn't have it to more than 50% of their customers. Comcast asserted that they would qualify for that year. And we sent out a questionnaire to all the companies that had qualified. All three companies received a questionnaire. And based off of the information in that questionnaire, we decided that we did not feel that they had built, maintained, and operated the project as described by the PUC.
While we're on that questionnaire, is that public information or is that proprietary at this
point? No, that's considered a part of their annual statement, which is the annual reporting process. So it's very much akin to their tax return. So that is confidential information held by the Department of Revenue.
Thank you. And it would only become public, I assume, in the event of public litigation.
The court can seal documents sometimes, so I can't say that litigation will bring it out.
Okay. Representative Benz, please.
Thank you. And it was a follow-up on the $67 million. The assertion has been made that the $67 million would not have been spent but for the exemption. Exactly. But if it was all linked to if it was partially for other purposes and partially for gigabit, it would be nice to know how much was actually caused as a result or prompted as a result or occurred as a result of this exemption. Because it's been said that the full $67 million we would not have had but for this, but I'm not hearing that. I'm hearing instead that there might have been a build-out going on and perhaps a gigabit was caught up in it or part of it or something. How would we ever find out how much was actually spent as a result of this exemption out of the $67 million for the gigabit service or offering?
And I think that is a question for all three of you.
So do you want me to take that? Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, when the PUC was putting together the reporting requirements by administrative rule, I know that they worked with the companies and they got a little bit of pushback on what detail of information would be provided. The Department of Revenue submitted a letter and we said that it would be very helpful if you were to break those dollars into buckets, money that's exclusively for the qualified service and money that while it may enable the company to offer the qualified service, it may also allow them to offer cable television, voice over internet, lower speed internet, business services. So I think that would be helpful information.
But you've asked for it. We don't have it yet.
No, the rules that are in place for what the companies have to report do not require it. So.
Another follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Please, yeah.
So, well, one hates to say, unless someone steps up and says, this is how much was for the gigabit, we have a hard time valuing this. So perhaps someone will come forward and tell us what the real numbers are so we can have a better idea of how much we paid for what we got. And that brings us to another issue, which is what did we get? And I guess that goes to a bunch of perhaps subjective elements, but... Yeah, how many people are using this service and how much value does it have to them? That would be very helpful also. Yeah.
Just to add, to pile on a little bit, we will be considering a couple of bills related to this issue, and we will be asking those kinds of questions. Yeah. I'm sure Representative Benz will if I forget. of the people who may have interest in those bills. Mm-hmm. Not the two of you, but the people who have interest in those bills. I think it's no secret that I disagreed with the Attorney General's opinion about what this bill required. I testified at the March 1 hearing on the issue at the PUC and said so. But the result of what the PUC learned from the opinion of the AG, as I understand it, essentially was that the definitions as contained in the report and as presented to us are based on the legal opinion of the Attorney General's office, and that allowed them to commingle the different components that Representative Benz referenced in his question. I disagree with that interpretation. What we really need to know isn't what would they have done in their normal course of business but for this gigabit service, but rather what did they actually do in reliance on this law, which was different from what they would have done anyway. Unfortunately, the AG, in interpreting the statute, disagreed with what we thought we were had done in the bill. But now I want to go on to other questions. I think, Representative Marsh, I interrupted you, and so you go next.
I'm just wondering, so we have a two-step process for issuing this credit. First, we have the PUC look at various criteria, but then revenue is also, it's sort of a, are they really doing it part of it? Is it useful to have this two-step process? I mean, it seems like you're reviewing a lot of the same information at different levels.
So, Representative Barnhart, Representative Marsh, or Chair Barnhart, apologize. You know, my understanding of why the PUC was brought in was that because of some of my engineering staff and some of those, that we had a little bit more of the technical expertise to go out and determine whether or not projects were capable of providing the gigabit service. Mm. And so, for example, with the Google plan, we had to look at the network architecture that they put together, the equipment, the switching, and things along those lines. And so that was to take advantage of our skill set and then simply say, yes, the project does appear to meet the requirements of the gig service and all that, before handing it over to Department of Revenue, who determines the second step as to whether they get the exemption or not. And I do see, you know, there is a little bit of overlap there, but I think they are fairly distinct different questions.
Yes, please.
But it does sound like revenue is then sent, you're assessing whether they're theoretically capable of doing it. Revenue is sending out a as I understood on a very simplistic basis, a survey to say, are they actually doing it, which is kind of the key question here. So it just prompts the question for me as to whether there's a useful collaboration or whether it's really just duplication of effort.
I think the PUC accurately reflects what we thought we were doing mm-hmm. in this regard. I mean, there's other things that I have strong disagreements with what the PUC did, but I think in this regard, that's exactly why we chose the PUC as the one to do the first step, was we thought they had the technical expertise to evaluate the specifics. Let me go down. Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that timing worked out well, because what I'd wanted to ask, and I think this is a DOR question, which is what Representative Marsh said about the PUC assessing that overall and then the DOR deciding whether it had been fulfilled. And one of the fulfillment measures I would say is, has this service or is this service actually being or has been offered to any customers? And is that part of what you guys used in making that decision? And do we know if indeed this service is or has ever been offered to customers? Because the capacity for the service and offering the service are two different things.
Sure. Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Smith-Warner. I want to give you a non-answer. Obviously, the department's in litigation on this issue. The company did not agree with our decision to not grant the exemption. We looked at a number of factors. What we tried to focus on was whether the project had been built, maintained, and operated. The bill seems to set the bill could do a better job of laying out what the Department of Revenue's role was, not to criticize it, but what we've tried to focus on are the things that we feel are the most defensible, and so that primarily has been, has it been built, maintained, and operated. And we were able to, based off of information that we received or didn't receive, we were able to make a decision, and we maybe didn't go all the way down, you know, as far as we could have gone. So,
thank you.
I would note that it artfully in the report is a sentence on page 5 under item 4. As of June 30th, 2016, 1% or less of Comcast customers subscribed to the Gigabit Pro service. Mm-hmm. Of course, that number could be zero. I will note that on March 1st, after this hearing, I called Comcast from the telephone on the floor of the House, because we were in session, asking them to provide me with information about installing gigabit service at my house in Eugene, where we are Comcast subscribers. They said they would report back to me within 5 days to let me know what the possibilities of that were. I note in their advertising at the time they wanted $1,000 for installation and $300 for the monthly service, both of which, in my opinion at least, meant that they weren't making a serious offer, and therefore it wasn't available within the terms of the statute. Another issue that the Attorney General and I disagreed about what that meant. The upshot of that is I've never heard back from Comcast in answer to my question, and I see the grin, and I would agree with it if I weren't so angry about the way this process has worked out. Next, we have Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My original question has been answered, but I just have a quick follow-up for the Department of Revenue. Do you have an estimation of what the litigation is going to cost the state of Oregon?
Representative Barnhart, or I'm sorry, Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith, we've invested a lot of money into the litigation around the Central Assessment of Communication Companies. The department came to the legislature in 2007, I believe, and said that if you folks didn't tell us not to, basically, we were going to go ahead and pick up communication companies. We did that, and we have been in court ever since, as was described by Kyle. We won a ruling at the Supreme Court that that communication companies are centrally accessible, but then we've been remanded back to tax court right now to determine what that means as far as the taxable value of the companies, and so that's what we're litigating. There are other communication companies that are kind of in line behind Comcast, so even if we were just to fold up our tent on Comcast, it wouldn't necessarily mean that we would be out of court, because we would still have to resolve that issue for other companies. The most recent number that I have is probably about, I can get you a better number, but the most recent number I have is that we've maybe spent $350,000 on it so far. So not inexpensive, but when you look at the relative to the amount of money that we're talking about, it seems like it's worth doing. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Nose, please.
So I think I'm confused about something we discussed a while back when Kyle Easton was looking at something. It says, back to overview of changes made by Senate Bill 611, 215, and buried in it is an estimate of for one biennium, it's worth $1 million, and then another, the franchise and satellites, that's worth $42.3 million. But I could have swore I heard somebody say we haven't collected any money, or so I'm confused about what these are. Do these folks not get the credit, or that's why we're in court, they're waiting to get it, and this is what it's worth if we repeal them, or?
Representative Noe, so there's three components, or there are three exemptions within the Senate Bill 611, so those are the other two, and there can be some cross-pollination. Certainly if a communication company that's applying for the gigabit service exemption certainly would have possibly franchises, FCC licenses, or even satellites or something to that effect. So there could be some mix there between the revenue impacts, but those are more standalone, and that's what's being exempt right now under those statutes. So the gigabit portion is, as Department of Revenue was describing, there's quite a bit of litigation going on that...
I noticed there's no estimate for that.
And there is, so we do have some information, and I can make this available. I didn't want to cloud things too much in the discussion here about going back to, as DOR described, when the Department of Revenue first changed the communication, who was within that communication, a bucket, if you will, and subject to central assessment. There was a court case that's ongoing since then. It has been remanded back to the tax court. Without spending too much time, what was put in place in somewhat in response to that was something called deferred billing credits. So to help hedge, I guess, against the possibility of a large refund coming due in, say, after 10 years of litigation, if it ruled against the Department of Revenue and the local governments, they would have to refund all those dollars they've collected over the past 10 years, which could be quite sizable. Rather than collecting those dollars, it's just an amount that is marked as owed, but the company doesn't have to pay them, the local governments don't collect them, and there's no interest on either side. And that's another part, is if the court case ruled against Department of Revenue, so local governments or the property taxes that would be refunded with interest. But the amount there for all deferred billing credits, and most of this really is about this communication issue, the last number I saw, which is a year behind us, for the 15-16 reporting, summed to about $130 million total. So that's for all the years combined. So we're another year already past that, so it's probably another $15-20 million above that. But that gives you some sense. And that, of course, would be at almost 10 years at this point. So maybe a $15-20 million, but it is a sizable amount, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, and that's only tangentially related to this report, isn't it?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and that's why I didn't include it in the meeting materials, but I'd be happy to circulate those.
Great. I think that would be helpful. Representative Bueller, please.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Chair. Can you give me a comparison to how the states of Washington and California handle this situation with communication-related companies?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Bueller, we did a survey at one point of all the different states as far as how they handle central assessment, who they pick up. It is a kind of a moving target. Different states have had litigation recently over whether or not voice over internet is telecommunications, but I think it is safe to say that Oregon does include more companies than most states, and that we tend to pick up more intangible value than some other states. I think that's a fair statement. I can't tell you exactly what Washington and California do. I could get that for you. We could look into that. I don't know if...
I don't have anything more up to date, Representative Bueller. I do remember, and it was from Department of Revenue, the survey that they mentioned. We have that in the meeting materials back to this original legislation, the 611. I ran across that the other day, but it would be a little dated, but we can definitely work to revise that and update that.
Well, why don't you at least drag it out and let us see what you have now before you put a lot more effort into it. But I think it'd be useful information, wouldn't it, Representative?
Yeah, especially since, you know, on the map you have in your materials that Oregon has slower connectivity for the state than our neighboring states on the West Coast, which I don't know if there's a correlation there, but it looks like there's less investment in connectivity in this state than compared to Oregon and Washington, which is not convenient for our citizens nor puts us at a competitive disadvantage.
Well, and I think that's especially true in the rural areas. It may be true in other urbanized parts of the state as well, but I think it's especially true in rural areas, and that's something that I think should be a priority for the legislature to fix. And other questions on this report today? Thank you very much. You've been a good sport. We appreciate your coming.
Appreciate it. Thank you for your time.
So I think we'll move on now to the bill that I opened and closed. We'll reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2281. And Kyle, you're on that one, and you were just about to start talking about it when I interrupted you.
You wanted to start with 2281 or 2280?
I was told to start with 2281, okay. And there must be a reason for that, but I'm not sure what it is.
Both DOR bills.
Yes. And Mark is here, so...
Okay, Mr. Chair. So House Bill 2281 is a bill that comes from the governor on behalf of Department of Revenue. What the bill does is it modifies some of the timing related to disqualification of designated western eastern forest land that's discovered by the county assessor as no longer being forest land. And I'll quickly rehash a discussion that this committee had in the property tax overview, but a key component that this this measure relates to is the difference between you have an assessment year and you have a tax year on that, for the property tax system. The property tax year functions similar or to the same time frame as a fiscal year. So you can think of that same way. It's starting the July 1 going through June 30. The tax year and the assessment date, they both begin on the January 1 and they run as a calendar year. So January 1 through the end of December. So what this bill is doing is it's changing the timing of the land disqualification from occurring based upon the January 1 assessment date of the tax year to the January 1 assessment date of the assessment year in which the discovery by the assessor occurs. So it's lining up those two tax years.
Okay.
It's a bit nuanced, and I think I will allow Department of Revenue to give more background.
Right, and I note this is the governor's bill. Perhaps you could explain to us why the governor wants this and what the effect of it will be for on the assessor and on the landowner.
Sure. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. So at the Department of Revenue, we wear a lot of hats. One of the things that we do is we establish the specially assessed values on 7.9 million acres of forest land. We administer the small tract forest land severance tax, the forest product harvest tax that brings in about $30 million a biennium. We put on a lot of classes for county assessors who do forest land. They are the ones who actually will grant the special assessments, and then they're the ones who will disqualify the special assessments. And so we do classes, we do tech groups.
Let me interrupt for just a second. As being having a special assessment as forest land is a value to the landowner because?
Because they'll be special assessed. There are basically two types of property tax benefits, so to speak. There's an exemption where you just don't pay or maybe only pay a portion, and then there's special assessment where you're taxed at something other than real market value. And so this is special assessment of forest land. We do a similar thing with farmland, but you're taxed at a value that typically speaking is less than the real market value that the property would bring in. So the legislature has created this program because there's a value of having farmland. As subdivisions encroach on farmland, the land gets more valuable, or I'm sorry, on forest land, as it gets more valuable, you know, you really can't make a living doing, you know, logging, I guess, is the notion. So
in effect, then, what we're saying is we're going to tax you based on the value of the land as forest land rather than the value of the land at the value you might be able to sell it for.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, again, we put on these classes and tech groups, and so we have to be able to tell folks how it is that you're supposed to administer these programs. And this really is just a bill to enhance clarity. The Legislative Council does a revisor's bill. This is the why are we here. Legislative Council does a revisor's bill every year, but they're very careful about what they put into that bill. It corrects erroneous material in the tax statutes. This is not really erroneous so much as it is just very unclear, and it really does just deal with the dates that apply when you are disqualifying somebody for special assessment. So this is always so confusing, and Kyle, please correct me if I'm wrong, but we are in the 16-17 tax year, July 1 to June 30th, and the assessment date is January 1 of 2016. So it's quite a ways back.
Yes.
So you're paying right now on your January 1, 2016 value. You got your bill back in October or November if you own property in Oregon. Mm-hmm. So what this does is what we think happened is that we had some statutes that were in place. Measure 50 split out tax year from assessment year. A lot of the statutes were, they went through them and they just changed the reference from tax year to assessment year. But here they didn't do that. And so the language is just very confusing. The statute as it's written now tells the assessor what to do only for a 45-day window, only through July 1 to August 15th. What does the assessor do for the rest of the year? Well, that's where it gets complicated. Let me point you to some general statutes. Let me point you to some case law. You know, but basically The notion is that if the assessor notifies you by August 15th that your forest land has been disqualified, then you are disqualified for that tax year. And that is the state of the situation now. And, you know, we met with the Small Woodlands Association. We met with the Oregon Forestry and Industries Council. And I'll tell you what I told them. And that is just that this will not change how disqualifications are administered in Oregon. All it will do is make it much easier for us to explain it to people. So,
if I have to carry the bill, that's what I'm
you
saying.
You want that one?
Yep.
write it down.
I don't want to carry it.
Write it down. All right. We give the most complicated bills to the new members.
I think Rivers and Hernandez was secured.
He may
sure.
want that one.
Good bills.
That's assuming he gets out of committee. Anything else to add to that, or are you ready for questions?
I think I'm ready for questions.
All right. Questions on the bill?
No, I'm good.
All right. You don't think this is anything... this doesn't actually... As it appears to do, it doesn't actually give the landowner the opportunity to hide what he's doing and keep collecting or keep getting his qualification until it's discovered. That's the current law. But all we're doing is changing the dates as to when the assessor can act.
Again, we're not actually changing the dates as to when the assessor can act. We're just making it so that you can look at this language and know what to do year-round instead of looking at this language and only knowing what to do during that 45-day window. So it just saves people from having to go and do a bunch of additional homework in order to disqualify somebody outside of that 45-day window. But it won't change enforcement. It won't change administration.
Okay.
It won't change the dates.
Interesting.
This is how the farm use special assessment disqualification is written, okay. More or less.
Right.
And we just wanted to make things easier for program folks.
Right. Thank you. Is there anyone else here to be heard on this bill today? I will note for the committee that bills that actually have a substantive effect that involve forest land usually end up with a significant number of witnesses coming in to explain why it's a good or not so good idea. The fact that they're not here, I think,
well,
has meaning.
He was here, but he left.
Oh, he was here, but he left.
Roger was here.
Oh, he was. Mm-hmm. Okay. But he didn't sign up.
It's fine.
So, all right. All right. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2281. And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2280. You might as well stay right there. Kyle?
Okay, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2280 is also a bill from the Department of Revenue or from the governor. This bill is a little unique in that the SMS, I believe, has more words than the actual measure.
Related clause.
But what the measure will do is it will repeal ORS 308-325, effective 91 days following signing die. I do include in the background of the SMS ORS 311-250. What that does is it requires the county tax collector deliver or mail. Excuse me, 308-325, the statute as it's written today, is it allows any person for any year, they can demand the assessor an official certificate of the fact that they have been assessed for that year. And if the assessor refuses to give that certificate, the assessor is fined $100, and that is collected by the person demanding the certificate, so long as they're there with the justice of the peace of the county. So I also include in the background that 311-250 does require the county tax collector to deliver mail tax statements on or before October 25th. And then in addition to that, a number of counties do make tax statements available on their website as well. You can search using an address or the property ID.
I didn't know that.
So for what that is worth.
Okay.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, again, not here to waste the committee's time. One of the things that we have to do at the Department of Revenue is we have broad oversight authority for the property tax system. That involves going through and getting rid of statutes that are in conflict with other statutes or that just are simply no longer relevant. And this definitely falls into both of those categories. Kyle explained what the statute does quite well. I was curious when the statute was passed. It was 1907. I was curious what $100 would be today. It's $2,500 almost. So this was a pretty big, fine that they could do back then. But as Kyle said, we have a little bit more robust property tax system now. People get property tax statements. And this statute actually conflicts directly with ORS 30. 5410, which gives the Oregon Tax Court the sole exclusive and final judicial authority over questions of law and fact arising out of the tax laws of the state. So the justice of the peace really isn't involved. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Wow. All right. Any questions? There's a whole bunch of different ways of getting the information that's contained in the certificate now, aren't there? I mean, my recollection is I wanted to know something about my taxes not too long ago, and I went to the county website, looked them up, and it was there. That's true everywhere, isn't it?
Chair Barnhart, that's true in many counties.
Most many counties.
Some counties have different systems. Some counties you might have to go into the assessor's office to get the information. Sometimes they have a computer in the lobby. They're not hooked up to the network. Assessors have different concerns about privacy and whatnot. So,
well,
but
and of course,
the information is available at the assessor's office, and yeah. They will share it with you.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Anyone else want to be heard on this bill? I don't see anyone. With that, we'll close the public hearing.
I don't think it needs an emergency clause.
There's no emergency clause. thank you. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2280. Are we ready to go? Go ahead. He's back. Okay. So we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2285. Yes. Okay. Useful information in that hearing was the value of the dollar.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2285 would change some dates that the taxpayer would have the tax that they owed assessed in some cases in which they still owe tax at the time that they file a return. There's also a little bit of an amendment coming on this bill that potentially just kind of makes the language a little bit more clear. It will change a little bit of the language. So the current edit that's done in the bill says date of the original return, mm-hmm. And the language determined with regard to any extension of time granted for the filing of the return, or the date the return is filed, whichever is later. That's the current language in the bill. And the suggested language just really kind of makes it clear that the date of the original return determined without regard to any extension of time granted for the filing of the return or until the date the return is filed, whichever is later. And so that's just a little bit, makes it a little bit clearer in the proposed amendment. But the folks from DOR are here today to explain the reasons that this bill is necessary.
Thank you. Long bill, but only a few word changes.
Mm-hmm. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Lois Williams, and I'm with the Oregon Department of Revenue. This is another administrative procedure that we wanted to bring to you so that we could get some clarity. Currently, when a taxpayer files a tax due return on extension and doesn't pay the full amount of tax due, the department cannot issue a notice of assessment to them until after the extended due date. As a result, the department cannot begin to take any collection action until after that date, which could be months after the return was filed. So, for example, a taxpayer who files an extension has until October 15th to file their return. If they file their return in June with a balance owing, we are not able to send them that assessment notice until after the mid-October due date. And this causes two problems. One, we cannot take collection action between June and October. And as I hope you are aware, that contacting debtors as early as possible when the debt is still fresh gives us the best chance of collecting that debt. But two, many taxpayers are also unaware that that unpaid balance continues to accrue interest throughout that period. Now, sending them an assessment notice as early as possible will inform them about their payment options, which could reduce the amount of interest they pay in the long run. In addition, by statute, the department begins charging an additional layer of interest called Tier 2 interest. 60 days after an assessment goes unpaid. So since these debts don't currently assess until after the mid-October extended due date, Tier 2 interest is not imposed until 60 days after that. Now, these two issues can create inequities between taxpayers. So two taxpayers can file their balance due return on the same day, say June 15th. The taxpayer who did not file an extension will have their tax debt assessed almost immediately. Collection efforts will trigger, and Tier 2 interest will begin 60 days if the debt remains unpaid. The taxpayer who did file an extension will not receive a notice of assessment until mid-October, will not be contacted for collection enforcement, and will not have their Tier 2 interest imposed until sometime in December. Mm. Now, for these reasons, Senate Bill 2285 proposes that we change that assessment date on self-reported tax due returns that are filed on extension but without full payment. This will enable us to contact those taxpayers sooner and will alleviate potential inequities between similarly situated taxpayers. This will also align us with a very similar provision that the IRS has for when they issue their notices. Mm-hmm. Now, the amendment to which Christine referred to is just a language change that would restore the bracketed material that's currently in the bill itself, but would change the word with to without. We're doing this to remove any perceived ambiguity, making it very perfectly clear which dates we're talking about. In the phrasing of, it's going to be the later of the original due date, which for 99% of taxpayers is April 15th, or the date that they filed their return during that extension period. With that, we'll take any questions.
Right. So this actually does change the law on the, as you described it, so that the tax becomes due on the date the return is filed, rather than on the extension date.
Well, Chair Barnhart, just to clarify, the tax is due on April 15th.
Well, okay.
But yes, it is assessed.
Your capacity to go out and try to collect it, and interest runs running, or at least Tier 2 interest starting within 60 days, as you explained. I think I'm understanding that. If I understand it correctly, what this would say would be assessed on the due date of the original return determined without regard to any extension of time granted for the filing of the return. That's the essence of what this language would be, and it's in a couple of different places in this bill.
That's correct, Chair Barnhart. It appears in three times throughout this bill.
In different ORS sections.
Yes.
All right. Any other questions? Yes, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you clarify what Tier 1 and Tier 2 interest are?
That would be a great question.
Sure. By statute, the department charges an interest rate on tax due when it's not paid timely. In this current environment, the interest rate is currently 5%. But if an amount of tax goes unpaid for an additional 60 days, an extra layer of interest called Tier 2 is added on. I believe it's 4 percentage points above, so in addition to the first tier.
Yeah. So it's higher than a lot of things, but still less than credit cards.
That's correct.
Yeah. All right. Any other questions? Is there anyone else who wants to be heard today on this bill? I don't see anyone. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. I think you may be up on the next one, too. You might as well stay right there. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on what am I on? On House Bill 2285. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2286. Chris,
okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2286 is a bill that deals with the transferability of tax credits. Hmm. I would, and it does come from the Department of Revenue. There's been a lot of talk about this over the years. I would describe the bill right now as kind of a conceptual bill. And the language in there is a starting point. In OLIS, just to provide a little bit of context, there's a document called Tax Credit Transfers, which is Section 4 of the Tax Credit Sunset Report that we got the other day. And this one just outlined that what the section does here is provide the two statutes that pertain to most tax credits. It's what you will, kind of a skeleton of limitations on tax credit transferability. And then the document goes through the six tax credits that are currently transferable. And those six credits are the agriculture, workforce housing construction credit, the biomass production or collection credit, energy conservation, transportation, residential energy, and the affordable housing lenders credit. So part the policy issue is each of the statutes for each of these bills and the transfer, the language is a little bit different. So they're kind, in some sense, they're all over the map as to how they can be transferred. So the idea of the language that's in 2286 is establishing one set procedure for transferring a tax credit. So as the legislature debates future tax credits or any given tax credit, if they want to make it refundable, they can just point to these statutes and simply say, this credit is transferable as spelled out in so forth, the statutes. There still is, and part of the reason I describe it as a conceptual bill at this point is we still need to go through the details for every tax credit to see if it makes sense. For example, one that stands out as different from the rest is the Affordable Housing Lenders Credit. That credit in and of itself isn't sold on the open market like the other credits are. That credit is transferable, but it follows the low-interest loans that accompany those projects. So that's basically a word of caution just to tread very carefully moving forward about what gets done to the word transferability and a sale of tax credits. But the value of having one place in statute is clarity for stakeholders, agencies. I think you're going to hear from the Department of Revenue from their perspective of what's important for them as the tax administrative agency. What information is important to them to get from the, if you will, the policy agencies that have the expertise in the subject matter, be it energy or housing or what have you. So there is a lot of language here. I would characterize it as a starting point. I think it's a pretty safe bet that there would be a lot of changes to the language that's written there right now, just in terms of from minutia to larger things, but again, focusing on that policy.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chair, for the record, Deanna Mack with the Department of Revenue, and Chris is exactly right. This is a bill that we brought through our legislative consent process for two reasons. The first dealt with the transferability components that he talked about, but also an administrative tool that we have in our new core system replacement is a tool, we call it our business credit manager. And so we want to be able to have uniformity in the way this various agencies who certify tax credits provide information to us about those tax credits so that we can load them into our data warehouse and process them in real time against the information that other agencies have provided to us. Some of the agencies have been doing this for years. Office of Rural Health has been providing us with information on the rural medical credit for years, so we can do that matching during the return processing. This will automate that process. So one big part of this bill, a conceptual part, is that administrative piece where we can get some uniformity in all of the different credits that are certified by other agencies and have that uniform information provided to us. The other big piece that Chris already talked about was the transferable procedures, the transferability procedures. Every one of the credits that are allowed to be transferred have different criteria on how that happens. And we hear from practitioners, we hear from taxpayers, oh man, I didn't do that one right. I had to get that one done within a year, and this one I have a different amount of time. So this is a big policy question. It's administrative ease, I think, for taxpayers and for practitioners. It would be nice to have that conversation. It is a policy question on whether you want to have these transferable credits be uniform in how they're transferred. It does make it easier for us to administer some, and I think it alleviates some confusion for taxpayers on differences between them. We have worked with all our state agencies partners on this as we developed the concept. We went out and talked to every single one of them, in particular about the requirement to provide information to us about their certified credits, and everyone is, to my knowledge, is on board. our partner agency, our sister agency, Energy, has come to us and said, look, we have missed a few of the credits. You'll see the first two or three pages of the bill are all new text, and the remainder of the bill is existing credits that are referring back to the new text, conforming kind of amendments. Mm-hmm. And we've missed a few, evidently, in there, so we would need an amendment at least for that. And then there's some minor technical changes. So like Chris said, we do view this kind of as a starting point for the discussion. We really would like to have the full use of our new system tool, Business Credit Manager, to be more efficient in the processing of these credits on the tax return, and then also have that conversation about the transferability provisions of the various tax credits. There's quite a few policy conversations to be had in that particular arena. So I won't go into the details of the bill because I know there's going to be amendments in the future that will change what it looks like. So,
okay, is somebody working on those? Is that happening?
Chris and I are working with them, and I have staff back at the office working with our energy folks to make sure that those are fine tuned so that we can get something to your office to work from.
Okay, all right. Any questions on this? On the way it is set up today. Yes, Representative Hernandez.
This is me being new question, but could you explain or could you give an example of when a tax credit is transferred broadly or what that process looks like?
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Hernandez, there are different processes in the current statutes now, but I'll give a real high-level one, is where you purchase, and of course I'm going to go to an energy credit because those are the most common ones that I can think of. If you purchased an energy credit or earned an energy credit and then you ended up not being able to use it on your tax return, you have an ability to transfer that credit to someone else who does. So the reason for transferability originally back in, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago, I think, was because there was some entities that were just not tax-paying entities, like nonprofits or government entities or schools, I believe, that they didn't have a tax liability, and so they wanted to still be able to incentivize them to improve their energy efficiency in those buildings. Mm-hmm. So they allowed for transferability to someone else who could use it. They have to pay for it. There's a calculation that Energy does for the value of the credit, the present value, or Chris could probably go into more detail about that. That's done by our partner agency at Energy, and they sell it for a discount, some sort of a discount based on the future value of the credit and the money that they claim. So that's what we mean when we transfer it. We're transferring it from one taxpayer who earned the credit to someone else who has purchased the credit.
And as she pointed out, may not be a taxpayer.
Exactly.
Correct. Right. One person who earned the credit, yes.
Right. The transferor might not be a taxpayer because they don't owe any. A church puts solar panels on the roof. They can't use the solar tax credit because they don't pay taxes.
So do they earn money? Oh, pardon me.
When you transfer a credit, the transferor receives money from the transferee. Mm-hmm. The transferee claims the tax credit on their tax return and reimburses themselves with that credit, usually with a profit.
Mm. Mr. Chair, so the Please. Church, hypothetically under what you just said, the church would receive additional funds because they earned that tax credit from the purchaser.
Correct.
Or school.
That's right. And that's a very simplified statement. Yes, please, go ahead.
To that point, at the end of that document, the tax credit transfers, there is a very simplified example of the potential tax implications of a buyer and seller. There are kind of two steps of a potential event that triggers a tax, and it walks through that process. Basically, the IRS has deemed tax credits a capital asset, and so they can be subject to tax when they're sold. And then even when if I purchase a tax credit, then when I use it, yeah, I incur a gain of income, and I should report that income as taxable as well.
Unless you're pardon.
Yes, Representative Hernandez.
Unless you're a nonprofit or school agency or government agency.
There's, as I'm kind of thinking, there might be some questions. I'm not sure how broad the tax exemption is for all nonprofits or the church and so forth about all sources. I don't know if they're exempt from all sources of income or not. So that's a question in my mind right now, just because of a very small wrinkle of the specific example that we're talking about.
Thank you.
Yeah, depends on whether they're subject to taxation on capital gains.
That kind of thing.
In right. this case, right.
Right.
Right. This is really a very complex topic. I'm sorry that Representative Bentz was called away because he had another committee meeting today, because he has spent a lot of time working on exactly this issue. And today we're making it look pretty simple. It really is. Representative Johnson.
So, Chris, could you touch on what the sideboards are regarding the discount rates on these credits, i.e. if I'm a non-taxpaying entity, what sort of parameters are there and how much the discount could actually be for?
Do we know that?
That's one of the factors that varies across the tax credits.
Let's talk on the RETCs or BETCs, let's just say, on energy conservation tax credits.
On the energy ones, in that chart, there is a chart in that document right there. This is for the energy tax credit, so it's the conservation and transportation. It's their EIP program, their energy incentives programs.
Mm-hmm.
And there are two types of credits. There are one-year credits and five-year credits. And the legislature required them to produce a formula to determine those rates. Mm-hmm. And that graph shows the history of those rates. The one-year credits, it's been 98-99% for the price. And the red line is for the five-year credits. And at the beginning, because of the formula, that price was very high. And that has led to some issues that are still outstanding.
Yes.
Right. And then, you know about that.
I know about them.
Yes.
And that's where they landed. And then the price fell to about 80% for a number of years.
Hmm.
And then it's following that path. There, other credits don't have any parameters.
Right.
There are federal credits that are sold different ways.
Right.
And it's kind of all over the map. If memory serves, the old energy tax credit was often sold for around 75%.
And our interest is that because the market's not efficient, that the seller actually gets a reasonable return on the tax credit. Otherwise, we would be better off simply giving the seller a grant
mm-hmm.
rather than allowing a tax credit with a profit to the buyer.
Sure.
If the if for example, the red line there accurately reflects the present value of the tax credit in the market, then it's fine. If it doesn't, if it's too low, then we would have been better off to simply have given a grant through the Ways and Means Committee process rather than a tax credit through the Revenue Committee process. And I think, I don't want to speak for Representative Bentz, but that's certainly been the set of issues mm-hmm. that he and I were working on for some time.
So there's no question then that it does result in a loss of revenue for the general fund. The question is how much.
Right.
Right, and whether we want
a haircut,
and whether we want to forego, right?
Is it worth that invest? Is it in the state's interest to offer this kind of tax credit that's going to result in a decrease in general fund revenue?
Bingo.
What's the trade-off?
Exactly the right question. And then
of course, follow up on that.
Please go ahead.
And then on that gain, or let's just say the benefit that the transferee or the buyer would have, let's say, that is supposed to be reportable, correct? The beneficiary that would make the $200 on the example you have at the end here, mm-hmm. where there's a $200 net benefit. That should be reportable as a capital gain.
On that second piece, that is just ordinary income.
Okay.
They're because they are the capital gain is, and Deanna might jump in with the exact wording. It's the disposal
right.
of a capital asset or the sale of a capital asset. And when they're using the tax credit, they're using the capital asset. It's a fine line, but it's a difference between capital gain and ordinary
right.
income.
And one other follow up. And part of the dust up we had recently in the last year over this is that there was. Via the department, there was a non-reporting of that, so that was not showing up, and the state has gone without a lot of capital gains revenue potentially just because of the mix-up or whatever happened in that process.
Right.
So,
of course, for the committee, knows. With new members, I'm not sure how much everyone knows about this, but at the federal level, capital gains are taxed at a lower rate than ordinary income. But that isn't true at the state level. At the state
right.
level, capital gains and wages and everything is all the same at the same rate. Representative Bueller, please.
Yeah, Mark covered what I was going to talk about.
He did. Okay. This is not a trivial issue.
No,
and
it's ongoing.
It's an ongoing question. Of course, the question that you didn't really mention but that I know you're interested in because you're on a school board has to do with the fact that there are some people who would like to sell credits, but because of the required margin that was in those earlier years, they were unable to because the present value of the credit was actually quite a bit less on the market than what the state insisted that they be paid, and so mm-hmm. they couldn't sell them. And that will be, I don't know if that's an issue we're going to deal with this year or not, but we might very well. I think it's something that's in the mix. Mm-hmm. Anything else for Deanna? Let's move on then to Jody Weiser, the other person who signed up. Is there anyone else in addition to Jody who wants to be heard today? Okay. Tax Fairness Oregon.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. So these have been messy for a long time, and they've caused some really bad press as well that's made everybody have red faces. But I think that while we're doing the changes that have been recommended, we might look at some additional changes to clean up the law. Our tax credits have all sorts of different lifespans. Some of them you have to use in 3 years, some of them 4 years, some 5 years, one's 9 years. You know, you get your first year, and then you have this long tail where you could use it. From my own experience, it's easy to forget that you have tax credits that you haven't finished using up. And so that might be part of the reason using for the legislature to use tax credits. It's good for the general fund. It's bad for the project that you're trying to support because they're going to get 80% of the value of the money. Mm-hmm. But it seems like there's not any particular logic. It's just whatever the bill crafter asked for. You know, a legislator says, well, make it a 5-year tax credit. So that's what it is. And I think it would make it a lot easier on the CPAs and the people who buy these things if they were all the same, had the same life. I think it would make sense if all of them had the same mechanism for coming up with a present value. We got the complicated mechanism for the energy tax credits because they were so much money. But I know of tax credits that sold for 64 cents on the dollar. And if we want solar panels on top of a school or a church or an industrial building, if they're going to get 64 cents on the dollar, why don't we give them a grant for 64 cents? That's cheaper to the general fund. And so at least I think we should make them all marketable and the value determined in the same way. And then under, I'm not even sure which one it is, one of the lender's credit ones, there's a line, it's on page 14, line 1. It says that the loan interest rate that qualifies for a subsidy must be less than 13.5%. Well, in real life, they are bargaining for better than 13.5%. But it shows that in our laws, we often set things at a percentage that seemed good at the time, but no longer makes sense. And the IRS has values that fluctuate with the market. They change every month. And it seems to me that we should put something in there that makes sense with fluctuating with the market. It's part of the reason we ended up with a problem with Comcast not paying interest, because we were going to have to pay so much interest to them. Then we ended up with rules that says, well, nobody will pay interest. And so when we have the opportunity to put an adjustable value in, it seems like that's a good time to do it. I don't know what adjustable value it should be, because I don't know anything about selling housing bonds, but there are people who will be in the building on Monday who do. And what I've included is some information about the federal changing rates, and you can see there are four different rates, and an Oregon adaptation of that law that sets a new rate every year, and so one could refer to 305.220, or one could do something to the federal rate that adjusts more often. But it seems like there should be something. We should start making that rational as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for Jody? Mm. Do you have proposed amendments that you'd like us to consider? Or
No.
Should we read this material and assume that?
That would be Chris's job.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I already asked if someone else wanted to be heard, so we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2286. We have no bill introduction work session today, so we'll skip that point. and we have a few minutes for the orientation. Let me simply note that we've had a request to consider business tax issues and review of the ways in which various states do their business taxes. We're going to take that subject up next week. So even if we don't finish this orientation this week, we will take up that issue next week. So become prepared to learn about the ways in which different states have determined that they want to tax businesses to provide support basic services in those states. I think you'll find it fascinating. We're going to spend all of Wednesday, I think, on we've taken out the material we had originally planned for Wednesday, and we're moving that to another day, so we can have adequate time to actually consider all the various options that the state might consider as we consider adjustments to business taxes. And I think that covers the thing I originally asked you to do. So let's go ahead then with the informational meeting on orientation. And I'm not carrying this over anymore, am I? We'll repost if we don't finish today.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I reposted for one of the days next week, so
okay.
We'll get back to it at that time. But you've got a pretty heavy schedule, Monday and Tuesday.
Okay.
Well, Monday we do have a segment for the tax reform, so we'll kind of kick that off.
Okay.
I'll get some material out for the committee members, to those that want to read ahead. I'll email
right.
you some of that material.
Right. That would be a great reading. One of the fascinating things about taxes in other states is that with the different histories that people have, they've come up with very imaginative and different ways of doing it. Some of them we might decide are better than one we use, and so it's a useful exercise. Please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, this is Dave Back, Legislative Revenue Office. So, considering the limited time we have, let me just go to just G5, straight to distribution formula, and I can add some details as we discuss this formula. So the legislature appropriates state school fund, and we add local revenue defined in the statute. Combined, it becomes so-called formula revenue for distribution. So this is the pot of money we are going to distribute to school districts and ESDs, so-called formula revenue, consisting of the state school fund.
Let's back up for just
a
second,
if
you don't mind. Sort of by way of orientation, the committee's name has changed over the years, but one of the earlier names was Revenue and School Funding, School Finance Committee.
Hmm.
This committee has been responsible for some time now, I think probably since 1991, for the manner in which the state school fund is distributed to the school districts and other school entities, and that's what we're talking about today. Is that piece of our responsibility? Thank you.
So, if you have any questions about the history, the start of it, and the evolution of it, I can help you. But at the same time, Chair Brownhart will be a great source too, as well as Paul. So, the state school fund, last biennium, we appropriated about $7.4 billion, and local revenue was about $3.65 billion. So, you get the ratio, about two-thirds state support, and then one-third local revenue. And local revenue is basically about 95% property taxes. Now, out of property taxes, local option is not included. Construction bond is not included. Only the part that's based on permanent rates will be included in this formula revenue. So the ratio is two-thirds state support, one-third local revenue. out-of-state school school fund, about $350 million was from lottery resources, lottery. The rest was general fund. So that's the big pot of money that will be available for distribution for school districts and ESDs. Now, this formula revenue is distributed 95.5% to school districts, 4.5% to ESDs. So here we're talking about school districts first. So 95.5% of total formula revenue. And how that much money is distributed to 197 school districts. And also some state schools and some institutions. All right, so if you look at the top of page G5.
Equalization formula.
All right. Yes.
There you go.
So then, so school districts gets the grant in the form of four. One is general purpose grant, transportation grant, high cost disability grant, and facility grant. So the most of revenue will be distributed in the form of general purpose grant with not much strings attached. Mm-hmm. Transportation grant, every year it's about $200 million, a little over. Now, because of mostly 70% reimbursement rate, the actual cost is about $300 million a year. And 70% 70% reimbursement rate brings this transportation grant to about $210 million a year. High-cost disability, some students have higher costs for instructions. And actually, we have set aside $35 million a year for high-cost disability students. Instructions. Now, this amount actually was doubled in 2015 session, almost doubled from $18 million from prior biennium. So then, because of that action, the reimbursement rate went up from about 42% to about close to 80% at this point. So it's a big improvement. Mm-hmm. And then finally, there's facility grant for schoolroom furnitures and stuff like that. That part is declining in number and dollar figures. That doesn't mean that the legislature is not helping with schools in terms of deferred maintenance. 2015 legislature also approved about $125 million GO bond to match the school district's facility improvement.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically matching the school district's raised revenue. The state will match that. So we can talk about technical details of this formula as we have specific bills in front of us. And I'm aware of some of the bills that try to change some of the weights assigned to certain students. We'll have that chance, but let me give you a big picture from very high up, just at an abstract level. So first, what is this so-called weighted students? Well, ADMW, average daily membership weighted, is consider some of the students actually require some additional instruction and support. And there, these students' schools actually face higher cost.
Right.
So take that into account. Mm-hmm. and let's give additional weights to these students so that the schools that educate these students get some additional support in terms of dollars. So that way, some students will get additional weights. So all the students, about over 570,000 students in Oregon, so we give additional weights to certain students who need additional instruction or services. If we add all these additional weights, then total weights become about 700,000. So about the headcount is about 570. You add up all the additional weights, because every student gets one weight from the start, but add additional weights combined, it becomes about 700,000 a year. And it's increasing, of course. And in 2015, actually, require all the school districts to provide either half-time or full-time kindergarten. And a lot of schools, my understanding is, they're providing a full-day kindergarten.
Yes, so, excuse me, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dave. So I was just looking at this, and according to this, the wait is still half for kindergarten, even though I thought that starting in 2015 we were.
Yes. So there are some schools who are still providing half-time. Mm-hmm. So these two schools and their school districts will get halfway. But full, yeah.
Right, but I thought we were. I know it's not mandated, but I thought we were paying for the full wait.
Oh, yes. One so way, total wait. Yeah.
If you provide,
so this is
if you do it.
Deceiving.
If you do it, you get one.
Okay, because it's just in it, the in your little box here. You still show it as a half weight.
Yeah.
So
if you do have,
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Smith Warner, yeah, we probably I'll have to correct that.
Okay.
Yeah.
And with that, we've reached the end of our time for our committee, and I'm about to lose the people, so there's no point in going on. We'll pick up this the next time we talk about it. Colleagues, this issue is one of those is another one of those that you, if you don't know the history of it, it doesn't make a lot of sense. But we'll talk about that on another day. And with that, we'll close the informational meeting until it's rescheduled, and the committee is adjourned. Thank you. And the committee is adjourned. Thank you.